Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast for the week of, well, let's call it Sunday, December 12th. I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And it was a national semifinal weekend, and in the end, we've got six in a row, purple on purple, and not just, of course, any two purple teams, but University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and Mount Union. And as Mount Union defeated Bethel by the score of 34-14, and Whitewater won at Wesley by the score of 27-7. Keith, you were at the Wesley-Whitewater game. I was at home monitoring both games simultaneously as much as possible, watching the really, I thought, very nice live video stream with some good enhancements this year from NCAA.com, including, of course, our broadcasters, which was nice, but also some new bells and whistles, some replay capability, and the embedded scoreboard clock, and things to kind of bring the video broadcast into 2007 or 2008 as we continue to get things a little better here in Division III. But Keith, you know, we came into the afternoon thinking that, you know, there was certainly at least a chance for Wesley to defeat Whitewater. Wesley was playing at home. You know, Wesley's had one of the best seasons it's had in years. And you know, maybe not so much hope if you're hoping against the rematch. Not so much hope that Bethel would beat Mount Union, but in the end, neither of them got it done again, as nobody has gotten it done in the playoffs against these teams any of the past 6 years. So my question to you is, what does it take and what will it take for someone to break through and beat one of these teams?
Well, Pat, you know, it's such a hard question to answer because there have been, if you go back, this is now the sixth year, each team has to win five games, you know, four to get to the Stag Bowl. So you're talking about, you know, 24 wins now in the playoffs for each of these teams, not including the Stag Bowls. You'd think something fluky would happen at one of those points, or one of these other semi-elite teams in Division III would come up and outplay them. And really, Pat, I asked that question to Wesley in the post game. I said, bottom line, you've played Mountain Union and Whitewater now the past two seasons in the semifinals. What's the difference between them and you and everyone else? And they said, we can play at that level, you know, but you can't make mistakes, and you can't, you have to outplay them. Neither of them give you anything. And you go back to these several times, you know, you can pick out over the course of these six runs games where each of them have been challenged, where each of them have you know, had tough games into the fourth quarter or deep into the second half. And bottom line, the other team is always the one who ends up making the mistakes, who gets taken out of its game plan, who isn't able to, you know, is made one dimensional, isn't able to establish what they want to establish. And the reward for that consistency is these six trips to Salem for Whitewater and for Mountain Union. And, you know, as much as people would love to see the variety, and I'm a fan of variety as much as anyone else, you can't begrudge these two teams because they earn it every year on the field. They earn it by being consistent, and they earn it by making the fewest mistakes. And if you take a look at, you know, the way these games unfolded on Saturday, there was a point, you know, maybe about an hour in, both the games kicked off at noon Eastern time, but so they were going on simultaneously. And there was a point about an hour in where Wesley's leading 7-3, and Bethel's leading Mount Union 7-0. And it wasn't, you know, Bethel scored quickly. They scored about 5 minutes into the game. Mount Union didn't come back and tie the game right away. You know, they went three and out a few times, and there was a point where, you know, it was 7-7 in that game, and you wonder, can this be a game for very long? And, you know, Mountain Union was able to do what they always do, which was roll it up over the course of the game. Whitewater does what it always does, you know, wear teams down the third, fourth quarter, got those turnovers, big turnovers in the second half to change the course of that game. And here we are staring at the same Stag Bowl. Bottom line is there are teams out there that can beat Mountain Union and Whitewater. You know, the Wesleys, the Mary Harden Baylors, the Linfield, you know, North Central, I think, joined that group this season. You know, maybe Trine is getting set to join that group. They played Whitewater tough early in the playoffs. There are teams across the country, maybe three or four, maybe six in a given year, maybe up to 12, you know, that can play with these guys. But the bottom line is they have to outplay them in a playoff game, be the team that's more consistent, that doesn't make the mistakes, that establishes its game plan. And I know that stuff is all really cliche in a certain way, but it's all so true, because you just don't see these teams fold under pressure. And that's why they're in Salem again, facing off with each other, which what really should be kind of an exciting sixth matchup, because you don't know which one of them is really the favorite.
And you don't know who's going to be taking snaps for either team. But we'll get more to that in a little bit. We're probably going to go back and forth between the two games, so we're not going to spend one large block of time on one game and one on the other game. So I'm going to skip back to the Mount Union Bethel game for a minute. Keith, there was you talked about making mistakes, and there's a point, and then there's a point in a lot of games against Mount Union where you can just sort of sense this is where the wheels are going to fall off. To Bethel's credit, they didn't pack the game in. They didn't stop trying. They kept playing hard, especially on offense. But the point at which the game became clearly Mount Union's was in the second quarter. Mount Union comes up with a quick play touchdown, the 80-yard pass to Cecil Shorts. He took a ball over the middle of the field and then just ran another 45 yards or so to the end zone. Whether he dropped the ball before he got into the end zone, people, which is a lot of discussion today, really rather irrelevant. The replays weren't terribly conclusive. Doesn't really matter at this point, because it was not a key part of the game. Bethel gets the ball back. They do get a first down, but they end up going four and out. The score at that point is 14-7. Mount Union comes down, drives the length of the field. Bethel holds them to a field goal. So it's 17-7. Bethel's getting the ball back with its timeouts and 3:13 to go. And on a short kickoff, the Bethel deep back comes up, and two Bethel players basically have a miscommunication and fumble the kickoff. So now Mount Union has the ball again. With 3:13 to go, already up 17-7, they tack on another touchdown before the end of the half, and it's 24-7. And from there, you know, it was pretty much coasting at that point. Bethel didn't score until the end of the game. They only had one other sustained drive all afternoon, and those are the kind of mistakes where, and it does seem like, Keith, too, somewhere in the point of the second quarter or close to halftime is often when these teams make the mistakes. It's to the point where, you know, I don't know if you want to, if you're facing a deficit and you have the opportunity to try to drive for a score, I don't know if you want to take that chance at that point. It's kind of a no-win situation.
See, I thought where you were going with that comment, Pat, was that if the wheels start to fall off in the second, third quarter, every game, week after week, that it's not a coincidence that these other teams, they're not just being outplayed by teams that are, you know, bigger or stronger, but they're being outcoached. And I don't know if you can say that was necessarily a major factor today in the game. You know, I thought Wesley staff and Whitewater staff were pretty well matched, and I don't know if, you know, I didn't get to see as closely the game in Ohio because, of course, I was in Delaware. But if every week to week, at the same sort of point in the game, a team is able to start to establish its dominance, you know, it's not a fluke. It's not a coincidence. And I think that's what stands out about these teams. You know, Mount Union has had a little bit of trouble this season getting up on teams early. And I shouldn't say this season, but these playoffs. You know, they haven't come out the gate and scored on their first 3-4 possessions like they have in some seasons. And that's not normal for any team, but for Mountain Union, sometimes it happens that way. But this season, you know, they struggled in the first half. You know, they were trailed 7-0 at the end of the first quarter on Saturday. Didn't score till 13-02 in the second quarter. And, again, that quick play to Short sort of gave them the lead and let them feel comfortable. But They had to feel Bethel out a little bit today. You know, that was a tough defense that they were going against, and they, some of their numbers are not really all that impressive. For the second week in a row, they were 4-16 on third down, and they were kind of, I think, average in the first half in the running game. Mountain Union was, but felt out Bethel over the course of the game, and obviously they had a big second quarter, the 24-point second quarter to blow that game open. in Delaware, you know, the Whitewater's MO is to sort of play teams, you know, toe-to-toe first couple quarters, that third quarter, maybe change things with some turnovers, and then that fourth quarter, you know, almost shut the passing game down, especially since they've been playing without their starting quarterback. But to shut the passing game down and lean on that run game, and especially if they're ahead, just wear the other team out with that that great offensive line they have, and then, of course, Lavelle Coppedge in the backfield. You know, the one chance, you know, your defense does beat one of the blocks, you got to tackle that guy in the backfield, and it hasn't been very easy. So, yeah, so their MO, I think, really is a little bit more to wear teams down in the second half, but also there's nothing fluky about it because they're designed to win that way. And I think, you know, the way the wheels came off in Delaware on Saturday was with Wesley. Once Whitewater got ahead, Wesley started turning the ball over, and Mike Drass, the coach of Wesley, identified it in the post game. He said there was about a 6 minute stretch in the third quarter where, you know, we made the mistakes and they punched through. That was his way of phrasing it, that they sort of knocked us out at that point in the game. And, you know, he even went to the boxing analogy where you got to keep your guard up the whole time. And the one time you drop your guard hand a little bit, you know, that punch that you normally block with that hand comes through and knocks you out. And that's how it was for Wesley, because that was a 10-7 game at the half. They came out in the third quarter, started moving the ball a little bit, and I think they felt good. And then they gave up the touchdown to Whitewater. Ball was tipped. Ellis Kraut re-injured his knee, went out. Matt McCulloch got the interception. Wesley punched it in for a touchdown. Then as they're down 10, Justin Sadler, the quarterback, trying to make something happen for Wesley, throws a kind of a bad pick over the middle. Greg Arnold, the middle linebacker, had dropped into his coverage and was really blanketing the receiver. And you don't see a middle linebacker, you know, 25, 30 yards down the field all that often in perfect coverage. But Greg Arnold was there the whole time. Sadler threw it right to him. And then, amazingly for a middle linebacker, he returns it about 60 yards all the way to the 1 yard line. And Whitewater goes up 24-7 at that point. And that was the point where the wheels started to come off a little bit for Wesley. Sadler finishes with 5 interceptions and was actually having a pretty good game at one point in that game, but the turnovers got to him, and then Whitewater was able to lean on that running game and kill the clock once they got the lead.
And Keith, let me ask, because this came up in the discussion of the game and in the discussion of the broadcast of the game, I wanted to get your full kind of extended take, not the 25 to 40 second in between plays take, on what you think might have been the difference, or how much of a difference would there have been at all, or if at all, if Ellis Kraut had been healthy. Like having seen Wesley in person, having seen Whitewater in person, for that matter, having played defensive back in Division III, I wanted to get your take on that.
Well, it's a two-pronged answer, Pat. It's not just the difference that Ellis Kraut would have made, but the difference that Wesley having its entire lineup would have made, and the team that it started the beginning of the season with. You know, every team has a spate of injuries over the course of a season, and the elite programs have the depth where a guy gets hurt and they're able to you know, pull someone else in to fill in. And of course, Whitewater and Mountain Union both pulled in their reserve quarterbacks to get them to the Stag Bowl this season. So it's not unique to Wesley, but Wesley lost their starting quarterback, their All-American tight end, their starting middle linebacker, their best cover corner. And then to have this blow where they lose Ellis Kraut in the Mary Hardin-Baylor game, he tore his ACL tore his MCL. He couldn't damage it anymore than it was already damaged if he tried to play. So we went ahead and suited up on Saturday. Wesley held him out in the first half. And he tried to come in and play and was trying to be a gamer, and he just wasn't himself, and hurt himself, I think, about the second series he was in. And he was out of the game. To answer the question, how different is the game? Certainly it's a major factor. Because when Wesley would get in trouble over the course of the past two seasons, whether, you know, third and long and they needed a big play, or they would get down in the red zone and instead of, you know, they know they're going to kick a field goal, if they don't convert, they would throw the fade to Ellis Kraut. And I think they told me a couple weeks ago, he literally, they're like 20 for 20 throwing the fade to Ellis Kraut inside the goal line. I mean, they every team, I guess they see it on film and they just don't stop it. So certainly that's something that would have had a chance to work against Whitewater when Wesley got close in. It would have made a difference on third downs. It would have made a difference because Wesley is a little bit vulnerable. Whitewater is a little bit vulnerable in the secondary. You know, the secondary played a nice game today, obviously, with the five interceptions. But Whitewater did give up that big play down the field to Matt Borelli, the 38-yard touchdown. That's how Wesley got on the board in this game. So there were some vulnerabilities at some point in this game in the secondary. How big a difference it would have made, I don't know if it would have turned the result, because Wesley was never able to establish the run. And they even talked about it in the post game, where they kind of went in at the half and said, okay, we're not going to be able to run it down these guys' throats, but we feel like we can move the ball in the passing game. And they were able to do that. You know, 16 first downs to 15 was the way this thing finished up. Warhawks to Wolverines. So they were able to move the ball. They weren't able to run it. And I don't know if they were quite the balanced, effective offense that they'd been all season, Wesley, but they certainly could have used somebody to bail them out on third and long or when they got down close. And Ellis Kraut would have been that guy. And they missed him. And they really missed just having an extra playmaker on the field, you know, when they needed it. Marcus Wilson tried to go both ways for them. He's their you know, top-notch cornerback, and he played some wide receiver, and they tried to get some big plays out of him on offense, but it just wasn't there for them. And really, a lot of it is a credit to the Warhawks defense, because they played tremendously. They took away Wesley's running game, and then of course once they dropped seven, they really never had to blitz. They got all their rush from four people, and so they had seven guys in coverage all day, and that's how they ended up with the five interceptions.
Keith, this is, of course, your second time seeing Wisconsin-Whitewater. And Whitewater, of course, is playing with injuries as well. The significant one, of course, being Lee Brekke starting instead of Matt Blanchard. Now, you've had a chance to see Whitewater once with Brekke, once with Blanchard. What was your take of the Warhawks on offense on Saturday?
You know, to be honest, in the first half, the offense with Lee Brekke looks a lot like it does with Matt Blanchard in the game. And what I mean by that is Brekke makes good decisions. He's, you know, they weren't as confident in him when he took over. Okay, at the beginning of these playoffs, they worried at the point of that Stevens Point game. I had a conversation with Lance Leipold after that game, you know, about so many other issues, but he was saying that, you know, one of the things they need to do is to be able to develop a backup for Matt Blanchard, because they don't know if he's going to make it through. And of course, he was just saying that offhand at the time. He didn't know that his Stag Bowl opportunity was going to ride on Lee Brekke. But the thing that they've done with Lee Brekke that's really, I guess, amazing might be the word. It's not overstating it at all. Is that they let him, I don't want to use the term manage the game, because that's so discredits what he does. He was making good decisions. He finished 13-19 on Saturday at Wesley, but he was at one point in the game 13-16. Threw a couple of interceptions. And had a couple passes broken up, and the ones he broken up, he's throwing to the right guy, but put too much air under the ball instead of throwing it really, you know, tight on a rope along the sideline to a wide open Aaron Roush. He floated it a little bit. Marcus Wilson was able to come over and make the breakup at one point. You know, he was making all the right decisions, and he was taking care of the ball for the Warhawks. And when you're playing with a defense that good and an offense that can resort to the running game late in the game and kill the clock, all you have to do is get your team ahead, let the defense do what it does, which is generate turnovers, put your offense in a good situation, make the right decisions when you have to throw, and then once they get ahead, they just leaned on the running game. I mean, again, Brekke was 13-16 shortly after halftime in this game, and then he finishes 13-19. Once Whitewater got those two big turnovers, really they had I think three interceptions on three consecutive drives at one point against Wesley in the third quarter, and they just at that point they just not shut it down, but they just ran the ball because it's effective, and it works, and because Lee Brekke didn't put them in too many bad situations, that their MO basically to win is let him pass in the first half, get ahead, and then in the second half run the ball down the other team's throat.
Yeah, Keith, on the other side, Matt Piloto getting his first real significant experience of the season at quarterback for Mountain Union. So Neil Seaman, for those who don't know, went out very early in the game. He threw an interception, and then on the return, tried to do, I guess, a bit of a slide tackle on the Bethel defensive back who was returning the ball, and got his leg kind of curled up underneath him. A Bethel blocker kind of ran him over, and he was down on the field for a little bit before being helped off, and he was worked on the trainer's table, never came back into the game. Matt Piloto comes off the bench. He'd thrown a handful of passes this season, not anywhere near as much experience as Seaman had last year going into the national semifinal game cold against Wesley. Piloto had even less this season in relief of Seaman. And Piloto looked a little bit shaky at first. Mountain Union went 3-and-out on three consecutive series. At one point, Cecil Shorts came in and ran the ball and ran a handoff, I believe, at quarterback in that span as well before Piloto came back in. But Piloto got his feet underneath him a little bit. He had the nice toss across the middle to Shorts that Shorts turned into the 80-yard touchdown. He hit Kyle Miller, the big tight end, for a touchdown that had tied the game back at the very early part of the second quarter. And in general, he looked all right. He looked all right for a guy who hadn't played all season. He was missing open guys. But he pulled the ball down and ran with it well. He threw a questionable ball into double coverage in the end zone that he was fortunate that Bethel didn't pick it off. Cecil Shorts bailed him out on at least one occasion. But, you know, we're looking at the situation, Keith, where both of these Stag Bowl teams may well, coming into Salem, not starting the guy who they started all season. Now, for Whitewater, obviously, if they start Lee Brecky, that's a guy who's made 5 starts in 5 weeks. There's probably a thought in Whitewater's head that even if Blanchard could go this week, do you start him after he's had a month off and a month of rust? Even if he's been practicing and warming up, he hasn't taken a snap in a live game since the second week of November.
Pat, it's funny. As soon as we went off the air, that's the first thing I turned and said to Gordon Mann, who was broadcasting the game with us, is even if Blanchard can go at this point, and I think we sort of hinted at last week that he may not be able to play again the rest of the season, and whether or not Whitewater knows it, we certainly don't know it. He was on the field during warm-ups, throwing the ball on Saturday, and gave a pretty impassioned speech talking about getting back to Salem, to the rest of the Warhawks. So I know he still checked in mentally. But yeah, that's the first thing I turned and said to Gordon is, I don't know if you start Blanchard next week, even if he could go, because at this point, Lee Brecky, they've won 4 playoff games with Lee Brecky, and not only that, they've won games when they've been tested. They've been tested at least the past 3 weeks, right, against Trine. It was 31-31 in the fourth quarter. Last week, late in the third quarter, North Central led 10-7, and this week in the third quarter, Wesley led 10-7. Or maybe, I guess, Whitewater led 10-7, but Wesley right in the game. And they figured out how to win with Lee Brecky. Everything's working now. To a degree, everything that's worked up to this point, you may throw out against Mountain Union because they're that good, especially defensively. But by the same token, a guy that's been cold, like you said, for a month, he was clearly the more talented quarterback, the guy they had confidence in at coming in at the beginning of the season. But yeah, the past few weeks, that's a That's a dilemma that Whitewater may have to deal with, or they may not have to deal with it at all if Blanchard is not ready to go. But it's certainly a question where, do you want to change what's been working these entire playoffs?
Brecky, over the course of the playoffs, or I should say over the course of the season, 58 for 91 passing. The 4 interceptions, a couple of them today, one of them against North Central in the end zone. 10 touchdowns against 4 interceptions, 722 yards. So they're not, they're not counting on him to carry the load in the passing game, but, they weren't really counting on Blanchard to be that guy either. Brecky's averaging about 180 yards or so in the games that he started, and Blanchard averaged, only about 30 yards more than that. It's not, I thought you said it nicely about how game manager has a bad connotation. But but that's along the lines of what he's doing. But the guy who's carrying the load is Lavelle Coppedge, and that's probably no surprise either.
You know, and there's five, maybe six other guys that are carrying the load too for Whitewater, and those are the guys up front. You know, starting with Robbie Ustruck and going across the formation all the way to the two tackles on the other side. Ryan Olsen comes in sometimes at right tackle for them. You know, the three All-Americans at center, guard, and right tackle for Whitewater, they can lean on that left side of the line when they have to. And up front, they make it comfortable for Lee Brekke, because he didn't have to face a whole lot of pressure, at least in the first half. Now, there were some times where Chris Mays, you know, the really talented defensive end for Wesley, Jeff Dorsey, the other talented defensive end for Wesley, where they just beat their man, you know, just good swim move, got around the corner, and Chris Mays is that good that he's going to do that a couple times over the course of the game. Dorsey was good enough to just, you know, bull rush one time and get in there. But for the most part, Lee Brekke didn't have to deal with a whole lot of pressure. And when you don't have to deal with a whole lot of pressure, then really it's just pass skeleton out there. 7-on-7, the part of practice where and you probably have a 15 or 10-minute period in every practice that you just run routes, And you throw against live defensive backs, live linebackers, so you throw into coverage, but you don't worry about getting pressure. Lee Brekke's been doing that since he arrived at Whitewater. So if the offensive line gives him enough time to where he doesn't have to worry about facing a whole lot of pressure, and that may not be the case against Lambert Budzinski and the front four for Mount Union this week, but if he doesn't have to worry about that pressure, then I think it's a little easier for him to settle in and get comfortable. And now, again, he started every playoff game for Whitewater. He's certainly very comfortable. And he is doing a little more than managing the game, because he can go down the field with it. He takes a big shot when he sees it, and he hit, you know, Wesley blew a coverage on Saturday, and Adam Brandis got open down the field, and Brekke was able to lay that ball out in front of him and let Brandis run under it. So, again, he's not a game manager in the sense that he can only make the safe throws. He will take his shots. But if the line gives him time, it's easy for him to get comfortable. And then, again, it's just like practice. It's the same thing he's been doing since he got to Whitewater. And so, if you're able to simplify it to that degree with the help of that offensive line up front, it's really not quite as much being thrown into the fire as it would be as if he was scrambling for his life and under a lot of pressure, and then also had to worry about making his reads and making the correct decisions.
I agree about Brekke, by the way. I think he threw a really nice deep ball when I saw him. He had good touch on short passes and throws in the backfield. You know, they didn't throw to the wide side of the field so much. He seemed to have a little trouble maybe getting too much air underneath it. And you know, anytime you do that, you're certainly opening yourself up to a pick six. And I wanted to talk also about the Warhawk defense. Just looking at what they've done over the course of the playoffs, they've given up a lot of points, or at least early in the playoffs they gave up a lot of points. They've just given up 17 points over the past 2 weeks. They've had 11 of their 19 interceptions in the playoffs. You know, nobody's run for 100 yards on them in the playoffs. So North Central certainly devoted a lot of resources to trying to get there. They ran it 38 times and only got 99 yards. Only one team has been over 100 yards on them on the season. Wesley was under zero. Franklin was under zero in the first round game. Is it Whitewater defense coming along, stepping up? One of the big questions that we had going into the playoffs was how they would handle a strong passing team, and that, you know, they did give up 373 yards to Franklin, and they gave up 276 yards through the air to Trine, but I would have to say they've passed that test so far. I'd be pretty happy with that.
Yeah, part of it, Pat, is when you get ahead to the degree that Whitewater's been able to get ahead in a couple of these games, the other team has to pass to get back in it. Also, talking about the teams that they faced, Franklin, a nice passing offense, Trine with the great quarterback, the Gagliardi Trophy finalist in Eric Watt, and then Justin Sotelaar, who's certainly for Wesley a pretty much of a pocket passer. And to be honest, North Central had a nice quarterback to wide receiver connection as well. So part of the passing number success, I think, is the quality of teams they faced. But the reason they've been able to defend it so well and sort of, I don't want to say bail out the secondary, but give those guys help, is that they can get pressure up front with just four guys. And when they can do that, it means the linebackers, Lane Olsen, Greg Arnold, and Max Ford across the front, those guys are the guys who are they just drop into coverage. They help out. And, you know, linebackers aren't necessarily always the best guys in coverage, but there were maybe four or five times over the course of this game where Greg Arnold was just draped on somebody. And a couple of times it was just a back out of the backfield or a tight end over the middle, which, you know, your linebacker should be able to cover those routes. But on his interception, it was a deep route over the middle, and he got underneath it like he's supposed to, and there's a safety playing over top, you know, helping out the deep ball. So it looks more open than it is sometimes for the quarterback, because you see the guy running free and you see the safety behind him, and you say, if I can just drop this in front of the safety, then it's open. But if Greg Arnold, the linebacker, is running underneath that, then he ends up, being where the ball is when the pass is delivered. And they help the way they're able to help in the passing game to force teams into being one-dimensional, and then, you know, they shut down the run up front, and then the teams feel like they have to pass quite a bit, and then they're able to get enough rush with just that front four with Luke Hibner and Wes Hicks and those guys up front, where they're able to use the linebackers. They don't have to gamble and blitz them and leave open holes in zone coverages or leave, you know, have your defense rotating so this man has to pick up that man or whatever. It's very simple. They can just drop seven guys off, and if your secondary can't necessarily match up with guys man-to-man, and that may be the case, you know, next Saturday in Salem, where, you know, there's not anybody on Whitewater that can man up with Cecil Shorts. And that's been the case in the past in the Stag Bowl. You remember they came out a couple years ago, went up top to Shorts twice, got that 14-0 lead and hung on to it. They're going to have to do this seven-man in coverage thing, I think, a little bit next week, because Kyle Miller is going to be tough to take away over the middle, and there's nobody really that can just cover Shorts man-to-man. But when you come out of a game against a team like Wesley that passes as well as they do with five interceptions, got to give a little bit of credit to that secondary, Matt McCulloch, Steve McCollum, Shane Covington, the free safety, and Jared Kisau, who had a couple of big plays. Those guys performed pretty well under, you know, basically as much pressure as you could be under when you consider who's passing against them, and the fact that we basically have said several times over the course of the past few weeks on these podcasts, Pat, that if there's an Achilles heel somewhere on this Whitewater team, it's that secondary. Those guys acquitted themselves pretty well today in Delaware.
Keith, on the looking at the other game, and then spinning a little bit ahead too, Jeremy Murray, number one running back for Mount Union, held under 4 yards a carry on Saturday afternoon, 19 carries for 66 yards against Bethel, which has done pretty well on run defense this year. I know you haven't seen the Mount Union Bethel game, and I appreciate you still recording the podcast on Saturday night, not having done that. But I know you've seen Mount Union play thanks to the wonders of DirecTV. DirecTV, who isn't a sponsor of D3Football.com, but as much as we talk about them, they might as well should be. They've certainly been great for our knowledge of what's going on elsewhere in the country. So my question to you, and it seems like all I'm doing this in this podcast is posing questions to you, but do you think that Mount Union can run on Whitewater? Do they have enough success to keep trying at it?
That's the not million-dollar question, the no-dollar question, I guess. It's the big question because, Pat, Mountain Union can't really afford to be one-dimensional against Whitewater. Nobody can. I mean, that's how Wesley got beat today. Wesley weren't able to run the ball with Brandon Wright, and you know, they were able to move it with short passes. They were able to move it with screens, but they were never able to really get their offensive rhythm going with the run. And Mountain Union is going to have to continue to try to stick with it, even if it's not working with Jeremy Murray. And you know, the thing about Coach Karras from Mountain Union is, He's quite a creative guy offensively, and he always tailors his offense to whoever is playing in the game for Mountain Union. So if Matt Piloto is a starting quarterback and he has a different skill set than Neil Seaman, you know, he ran the ball, sounded like, pretty well on Saturday, you know, maybe they'll use him a little bit in the running game and try to generate some run that way. You know, again, Cecil Shorts, takes direct snaps. He's a guy who came to Mountain Union as a quarterback. There's ways to get him the ball in the running game. So if they don't have that straight on success running the ball, there'll be some ways where they try to get different players involved and to try to keep Whitewater's defense off guard, because running straight ahead at these guys, it's not a very likely to win strategy. And, you know, maybe it's a little different when you have Mountain Union's offensive line, but it's proven over the course of the season, and me, you know, that you just don't line up and run it down the Warhawks defense.
Whitewater, over the course of these playoffs, has played Franklin at home, has played Trine at home, then went to North Central, went to Wesley. Mount Union, at home to St. Lawrence, home to Delaware Valley, home to Alfred, home to Bethel. They're two certainly pretty I would say they're paths that don't really compare very well with each other, shall we say. One of them certainly faced a much tougher road to Salem than the other. Do you think that has an effect on Saturday?
Yeah, I don't know how big a deal that is. I mean, I think Whitewater scores have been closer, and part of the reason is because they've had to play North Central and Trine and Wesley. You know, North Central and Wesley both will finish in our final top 25. For all intents and purposes, will be among the top six teams. You know, they came into the playoffs that way. So, you know, Whitewater, being a two seed, having to play two games on the road, you know, that's a big difference for them. And they definitely had the tougher road of the two. But does it mean Mountain Union wasn't tested over the course of the season? I don't think that's true. You know, I think they get a pretty good test when they play Ohio Northern, when they played Baldwin-Wallace in their regular conference schedule. You know, Delaware Valley was not a pushover. That was a team that Wesley, you know, needed a score in the fourth quarter to beat. So, and Mountain Union handled them pretty well. You know, Alfred was on fire in the playoffs. You can't knock what they've done. Regardless of how that strength compares, the bottom line is Mountain Union, if they're able to run the ball, you know, they play Whitewater in the Stag Bowl, and everything that's happened up to this point is sort of it becomes irrelevant to that point. Now, you can try to judge based on what we've seen, but Mountain Union and Whitewater are so far in a class of their own that the road that they've taken to get here, you know, it may not matter all that much, because Mountain Union, they could have played Whitewater's schedule, and they might have ended up in Salem as well. You know, they're just the two dominant teams, and I think the only teams, in all honesty, that really present the challenge to the degree where they don't have to play their absolute best game to win is each other. You know, that's the kind of rivalry that Mountain Union and Whitewater have established. So I don't know how big a deal the road to Salem has been for Mountain Union, even though it's certainly been easier than Whitewater's.
A lot of discussion on Saturday, as there was last year, actually as there was the year before, to be honest with you, is that seeing the same two teams in the championship game year after year is boring. I had a few responses to that. I'm going to try these out for size and see what you think and then get your take. First of all, you know, I think people who complain about seeing Mount Union and Whitewater in the championship game every year should go back to the span we had, you know, in the early part of the decade, where Mountain Union was the hands down favorite, and you know, in 2002, for example, was the favorite to win the national championship going away before the season even started, and it ended up going that way. They were far and away the best team. You know, now we've got a team that has consistently stepped up and taken Mount Union's best and taken away a couple of Stag Bowl victories in the process in Wisconsin Whitewater. So in that sense, I think that's good for Division III. There's been some talk, I think, from, you know, people who are just frustrated and would like to get to the Stag Bowl someday, that maybe the NCAA should match these teams up in the semifinals. And my response to that is, you know, would football fans rather see a great game in the Stag Bowl, or the potential for a great game, or would they rather see 34-14 and 27-7 in the Stag Bowl, like Mountain Union and Whitewater with the teams that they face today ended up with? And then of course the holy grail here would be for a third team to step up and challenge Mountain Union and Whitewater, and then eventually a fourth team, so that we have, you know, for example, what happened on Saturday in Division II. Northwest Missouri State had been to the Division II football championship game 5 years in a row, and they lost on Saturday to Minnesota Duluth. Earlier in the season, you know, I just remember glancing at a score and seeing that Grand Valley State had lost and thinking, that just never happens in Division III. You know, the two perennial favorites just don't lose regular season games. But I think it would be nice to see teams continue to stepped up to that challenge and try to make this not the same two teams every year. But even then, I don't think the same two teams this year is boring. I think we're going to have a great football game.
Yeah, the way I define it, Pat, or the way I would phrase it, is don't get the desire for variety confused with boredom. Boredom, why do we want to see variety? Because we want a game that's exciting. We want to have that drama, that suspense in the fourth quarter where you don't know who's going to win. Well, you get that with the Stag Bowl when Mountain Union and Whitewater play. Right? The game last year, the Snowball was tied at 28 in the fourth quarter. You go back the year before, and it was 31-26 was the final, and Whitewater fell behind and was coming on strong. You go back to the 07 game, and it was 31-21. There was a big turnover, and then the big Justin Beaver run that helped sort of seal it late in that game. These games have been competitive. You know, you get that. So I understand that we want to see variety. And to be quite honest, the variety is there when you zoom back out beyond the Stag Bowl. If you want, you know, to just satisfy that hunger, you know, we could always do what they did in the basketball championships up until this last season, Pat. Play a third place game in Salem. You know, maybe Friday night, Wesley and Bethel could face off for the championship of all the other guys, the Division 3A championship, if you want to call it 3AA, you know. And then Wesley or Bethel could consider themselves the champion of something, and then Mount Union and Whitewater can play for the Stag Bowl. You know, if it's really getting that boring. But the thing about it that's so genuine, that's so real. The reason you'll never see me on record knocking Whitewater or Mount Union's accomplishment is because they earn it every year on the field. And for all the consternation, every time the bracket comes out every year, you know, who's not seated in the right place, this, that, and the third. You know, the important thing is Mountain Union and Whitewater on the opposite sides of the bracket. There's no way we'd ever want to force them to play in the semifinal just to get the variety. You want that variety to be earned. It can happen, you know, but you have to beat those guys. And if you don't beat them, it means we don't have the variety in the final game. But it doesn't mean it's not the same thing as being boring. If you get what I'm trying to say, you know, boring is what you said, Pat, where you know week one, Mountain Union's going to win the championship this year, and everything else is just window dressing. You don't know necessarily who's going to win the championship at the start of the season, and you don't know right now, and even though we know which two teams are playing in Salem. You might say Whitewater goes in as the favorite. They're the defending champ. They both teams have to start their backup quarterback. Well, Whitewater's been starting their backup quarterback for 4 weeks now, or you know, 5 weeks, however many games it's technically been. Okay, but you got the drama. You don't know exactly can Lavelle Coppedge and that Whitewater offensive line, can they run against the 4-2-5 defense of Mountain Union? It's not boring. It's just a lack of other teams breaking through into that top two and bringing home that Stag Bowl hardware. But the thing about true competitors, and all of us that played here in D3, I think we would consider ourselves that, is that you don't want anything handed to you. You want to earn it. And these Wesley players, these Bethel players, they wouldn't have it any other way today than to try to go to the Stag Bowl through Mountain Union, to go through Whitewater. I think any championship earned any other way without beating these two teams that have now, for the course of six seasons, established themselves as the best in Division III, if you don't have to go through those guys, it would almost be kind of cheap. I'm sure you'd still enjoy it, but you'd love all the rest of us in Division III. That's how you want to win the championship, by going through one of those two teams. And that's how it's going to have to be done, because that's how we do it in Division III. You got to win it on the field.
And there's a lot of other things that go on in Salem this week, the week around the Stag Bowl, not just the game. You know, the tailgating in the parking lot beforehand, especially now that we have the afternoon kickoff slot, 3:30 Eastern time. You know, it's on ESPNU, which is not as nice. It's not on ESPN2 anymore. But we have the afternoon kickoff, which sets up the rest of the day nicely, Keith. There's going to be, of course, the tailgating in the parking lot. Hopefully there won't be 20 inches of snow in the parking lot on Saturday. I had heard the last time I looked out at an advanced weather forecast, and now this is still about a week down the line where we're looking at it, but I'd seen a high of 37 degrees on Saturday. That can obviously change quite a bit as things move out. But you know, so the tailgating in the parking lot, the folks from Stone Station, the people who run the tailgating show at Bridgewater College, came down for the championship game in 2001, and more or less haven't left since. They'll be there set up. We'll write a bit about more about that as the week goes on. And also, Keith, on Thursday night in Salem, the Gagliardi Trophy ceremony, which we will be involved with the live video broadcast of that. For those who don't remember, there's a bit of an added wrinkle this year in that we don't know who the winner is. Usually by now we would know who's going to be getting the hardware.
Pat, I would offer another added wrinkle in that the two teams in Salem, neither of those teams have the Gagliardi Trophy winner on it. You know, Aaron Rusch, the wide receiver for Whitewater, one of their two tremendous wide receivers, he was nominated, and he was one of the 10 semifinalists for the trophy, but he's not one of the four guys who's still up for it. And you also have to tip the hat to the J Club, that helps put together the Gagliardi Trophy, because this year, for the very first time, all four recipients are going to be on hand, and I think that just gives it a professional feel. It keeps all four fan bases interested. You know, Rowan's season has been over for 5 weeks now. Franklin's season has been over since they lost to Whitewater in the first round. Trine lost to Whitewater in the second round, and then the fan base from Louisiana College as well to join those fan bases from Trine, Franklin, and Rowan. You know, they're all involved now. They're following what's going on in Salem, and I think the you got to tip the hat to the Gagliardi Trophy committee for bringing those four teams down to Salem and getting them involved in that D3 experience. And now, you know, Mountain Union and Whitewater fans learn a little bit about Franklin and Trine and Louisiana College and Rowan, and those guys learn a little bit about the two teams that are down there in Salem, and everybody learns a little bit about, you know, the way Salem rolls out the red carpet for Division III. And, you know, as much as we Division IIIers take pride in playing for the love of the game and going through, you know, weird locker rooms and having subpar facilities and not getting, you know, free uniforms and all these other extra, you know, you don't walk around campus like a big shot because you play football and all that stuff. You know, it's nice when somebody treats it professionally and gives it a real good touch. And Salem has always done that for the Stag Bowl, and the Gagliardi Trophy committee bringing all four of those guys down to Salem, I think, is another nice touch. And it just makes the whole entire thing pretty fun. You know, we'll be there, of course, from Thursday through Saturday. So we'll enjoy the whole thing. And if you have any chance, if you're within driving distance, come on down. You honestly will not regret it if you love Division III football.
And just to take you through a little bit more about how the ceremony is going to go and the broadcast stuff for Thursday night. You know, the link hasn't been set up yet, but you'll be able to get it, of course, at d3football.com, especially since we're a part of it. Not that we would ignore something as big as this anyway. We'll join up about 15 minutes or so before the formal ceremony portion starts. They start dinner at a little bit after 7 o'clock Eastern time. And then the ceremony begins somewhat deeper into that. So I think it's going to be around 7:45, 8 o'clock Eastern time. Keith and I will take the air. We'll talk about the four finalists, of course, and then on the stage at the head table there's going to be a short video highlight of each of the guys. Each of the kids is going to be interviewed by the host for the ceremony. You know, they'll name the winner, and none of us will know beforehand. So you'll be as surprised as the rest of us. And then afterwards, after they receive the trophy and all the pictures are taken, Keith and I will sit down with the winner as well, and we'll talk with them about get their reaction and that sort of thing. So it'll be I'm looking forward to it being a pretty good production. We're bringing down an extra producer, Dave McHugh, our D3 Hoops guy who does a lot of production for the Hoopsville show, runs the Hoopsville show. We're going to bring him down and try to make this as special a show as possible and make sure that this ceremony gets the recognition it deserves. And of course, Keith, you know, it's not the equivalent of the Division III. It's not the Division III equivalent of the Heisman Trophy, but it's the most prestigious honor that Division III football has, and it should be treated as such.
Absolutely. You know, there's the award only goes back to the early 90s, so there's not even 20 guys who've ever won this award in history, and it's a it's a small fraternity of guys who have given themselves, you know, the way all of us who played Division III gave of ourselves to the game. But then these are the exemplary guys, the guys who've gone above and beyond. You know, none of them have to do this community service work. None of them have to be, you know, outstanding in the classroom as well as outstanding on the football field. But I think you love to have those guys stand up there and represent what we do in Division III, which, you know, you hear sometimes other divisions talk about, well, we can't shift our postseason around because, you know, these guys wouldn't be able to take finals. You know, we got guys right that are playing this week in the Stag Bowl that are going to move their finals up and take finals Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then come down to Salem on Thursday, play a championship game on Saturday. And these guys, the Gagliardi Trophy guys, they sort of represent that, you know, the balance between classwork, between you know, with classwork, of course, being the real reason why we're all in college, but then also being able to put in that top-notch effort on the field, and then not forgetting what's more important than football and school, quite honestly, you know, is the community that you live in, and giving something back to, you know, to the rest of the people on earth, not just the rest of the people who come in and root for you in the game. So it's really a tremendous honor to have those guys step up and represent the rest of us in Division III, and whichever one of the four wins it, he'll join a pretty proud fraternity. And of course, when you have John Gagliardi's name associated with you as a player, you know, this is the guy that's the all-time wins leader in college football history, any division. You know, really all-time wins leader in football history, and to be associated with him is quite an honor for any 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old.
And of course, we'll as we get ready for Stag Bowl 38 on Saturday, we'll continue to have more pregame coverage and more feature stories throughout the week. We will announce, as Keith mentioned, our Division III, our D3 football All-American team on Saturday. We'll have 2 hours plus of pregame show from the parking lot in amongst the fans in Salem, Virginia. We'll have audio broadcast of the 3.5 or so hour football game because we add TV timeouts. And then usually about an hour or so of post-game coverage. So stick with us all afternoon, you know, especially because I know a lot of people don't get ESPNU. The number that was quoted to us was that 73 million homes have it available, but I know available doesn't necessarily mean you all have it on your cable system. If you're not on the right tier, or if you don't have the right package on DirecTV, you may not have it either, for all I know. So stick with us, because we'll have it all for you. And at the very least, the way we've been broadcasting games using Ustream, there's very little delay, so you could very well put the mute button on your television, mute the people on ESPN who have never seen a Division III game, and listen to the people who know what Division III football is all about. That's me and Keith. We'll have Frank Rossi on the sidelines. Dave McHugh will be our producer, and we'll have all sorts of stuff between now and Saturday for Stag Bowl 38. If you want to know more about Stag Bowl 38, you need directions, information about tickets, information about hotels, that sort of thing, click on the Stag Bowl ad on the homepage on d3football.com. That'll take you right to the official Stag Bowl site. It's easier than me rattling off a long URL to get you there. Just click on the ad, and you'll get all the information you need there as well. So he's Keith McMillan. I'm Pat Coleman. Again, in under an hour, but not by a whole lot, it's the Around the Nation podcast for Week 15.